This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite hangout, doing our favorite thing, and that's talking a little politics. Brandon, lots on the agenda for this past week, starting off, and we missed it last week by just a nose, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective. But the EPA, Scott Pruitt, is no longer around. Mr. Scandal himself finally caught up to him.
Yeah, that's right. He had 14 separate probes concerning his business as EPA director, some personal, some government related. So this was something that was likely inevitable. Although to me, what's interesting is that it didn't last quite as long as other scandals that were in this same viewpoint. Like this was a scandal that lasted about 282 days, according to my count. The data that I've collected on scandal usually clocks in these kinds of cabinet member scandals that are personal in origin at about 420 days. So it felt like it took a long time, but in actuality, it probably didn't last as long as many of them on average.
I mean, to some extent, though, don't you think part of the issue in the era that we're in with the speed and velocity that news travels and how quickly it seems to penetrate sort of the general public's consciousness, I'm surprised he lasted that long. Because if you look at it, just never mind historical presidential cabinet level scandals, if you look at it vis-a-vis Trump era scandals,
right.
This guy was like Methuselah in office.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think that the standards are different now. I mean, you've got a scandal prone White House. And so what's another kind of scandal prone cabinet member in that mix? So that's probably why in part he hung on so long. But it is surprising that all of these things collected so quickly and didn't end up going anywhere. So what's the impact of this? I mean, what do you think's going to come of the Pruitt scandal, if anything?
Yeah, I think politics aside, the issue for me was Scott Pruitt was in many ways one of the most effective members of the Trump administration.
Also why it lasted so long,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, from a regulatory perspective, what they did in terms of remaking sort of the EPA, the direction of the EPA, rescinding many of the Obama-era regulations, I think is going to be felt for a while. It'll be interesting to see kind of what the steps are moving forward. His successor in office, I think, is going to sort of set the table to some extent. But it's a huge loss, I think, for the president, because this was someone that was really implementing a lot of what he wanted.
Yeah, I think it hurts the party brand at a pretty sensitive time. I mean, we're months away from midterm, and President Trump ran on the kind of drain the swamp line. This directly undercuts that. But no president is able to kind of keep that purity, right? Remember Jimmy Carter's, you know, we're going to have kind of clean government, right? And within the first few months, his friend Bert Lance was caught in a scandal, and that ended up basically undoing all of the kind of rhetorical goodwill that President Carter collected. So no president ever wins this kind of bright line kind of argument. But I do think that it ends up hurting the president, who had attempted to be able to kind of run as an outsider. And I think that that's no longer an option.
Well, speaking of running as an outsider, the president has found himself a bit of an outsider during the most recent NATO visit. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is sort of the large alliance that came out of World War II, most of Western Europe, the U.S., Canada. And it has become a huge sort of sticking point because the president has been taking them to task on various things like the amount of money they spend on defense spending. He wants to raise the amount they have. They've set targets for 2%. Essentially, no country is meeting that target right now. And the president's doing something interesting. He seems to be linking protection from a military alliance perspective, once again, to trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he tweeted out that he was in Brussels, but thinking about domestic farmers. So it's definitely the case that this is connected to his larger kind of political goals. They also took the fight to Germany here, right? He's really unhappy about this trade imbalance. He's accused Germany essentially of owing the U.S., you know, billions of dollars. And he said in a very unusual meeting over breakfast, apparently, that that it was the case that Germany was totally controlled by Russia because they get much of their energy from them. This was a statement that took place during a kind of breakfast where Kay Bailey Hutchinson, also a Texan, was having breakfast, and it was very awkward. If you I have the ability to take a Google search, look at the clip from this because it is hilarious. The look on Kay Bailey Hutchinson's face is like somebody brought up, you know, like politics at Thanksgiving dinner. John Kelly looks like he is visibly and physically uncomfortable. It was suggested from Sarah Huckabee Sanders that apparently that the reason he looked uncomfortable was because he was expecting a full breakfast, and instead there were only pastries and cheese.
It's
right?
Europe. He should recognize that you're not going to get eggs and bacon at every meal.
It's been a full 24 hours since I read this, and I am still like just delighted at how unusual this is. To be honest, if you were in Brussels and they gave you pastries and cheese, that's like a vacation, right?
So exactly.
I don't know why they're unhappy, but it's so bizarre. It's not going to get much better. I mean, this is a trip of friction. It's not a trip to build bridges. This is how the president's MO has been. So it's going to be, I think, more of this as things go on.
Yeah, look, I think if you distill away all of the sort of usual Trump rhetoric and kind of pompous language that he uses, I think essentially what he's doing is linking trade and economic issues to security issues and talking about it in a broad sense. Mm-hmm. There is an actual philosophical underpinning to what he's saying, which is this notion that energy security, economic security, and military security are all intertwined. NATO needs to adjust to that new reality. And that I think there is some actual value and resonance to that argument. Mm-hmm. The problem for the president, as he's often known to do, is he kind of steps over some of the nuance of that. And it looks like he's sort of lashing out when there's an actual coherent message he's trying to put forth. Doing it in a very effective way.
Well, but it's the same with NATO, same with the UN, rather. The president, I think, doesn't trust or like these institutions, and so he doesn't see the value in them. So as a result, he treats it like it's a doormat, and that's, I think, what likely the result of all of these kinds of meetings are going to be.
Well, shifting gears a bit, when we move over across the pond, as they say, to the United Kingdom, Brexit, the Great Britain's leaving the EU common market has created massive problems. Theresa May's government, she's the current prime minister, is effectively kind of imploding right now. She's lost three cabinet members, including the most prominent British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, resigned with a pretty scathing letter suggesting that Brexit is a disaster the way she is wanting to do it. Turmoil is probably a good description of what's going on in the United Kingdom. Brandon, what's your take on this?
Yeah, your description of this, especially related to the word leaving, is important here because Johnson resigned in part because he suggests that May's plan to exit the European Union is a big turd. So it is something that has been a point of contention inside the country. And the issue, I think, will not be kind of left here with this resignation. If May is weakened enough, they may call elections. And as a result, we may have Boris Johnson running against her. And so this could be a political issue in addition to a kind of a troublesome policy issue.
Yeah, I think the clock on the May government is probably ticking. And so you might see snap elections, a full-blown parliamentary election there. We may have a change in government. She barely held on last time. It would not be surprising if Labour is able to be successful in this environment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Brandon, let's move our focus back to the U.S. and talk about sort of the issue that has been dominating a lot of the coverage. And again, that's the issue surrounding children coming across the U.S. border. They were separated initially when the president changed policy, deciding to sort of criminally prosecute their parents. Mm-hmm. The White House missed a pretty significant deadline ordered by a federal district judge to reunite families. What's going on here? What are the ramifications moving forward?
Yeah, the judge ruled that children under the age of five should have been reunited with their families this week. It's apparently not going to happen. I think the number is something like half, even as of the time we're recording this. Children who are over five are set to be reunited at the end of July. The biggest problem here is not just the moral question, but the policy implications of having to make this happen. The shift in terms of how they approach this creates chaos, and not surprisingly, they're not able to execute it in a way that makes any kind of coherent sense. Families are now permanently damaged by this. The children who are kind of caught in between are likely to be scarred by this in some permanent way. So obviously, this is something which is going to be an ongoing issue, and it's unclear how the Trump White House plans to really address it to fix it.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's an easy fix for this. Yeah. I think this goes back to what we talked about in previous episodes, is that when you're dealing with multiple agencies in the federal government creating a coordinated response, can sometimes be really problematic.
Yeah.
And part of the problem here is the Trump administration is really running on a sort of a pottery barn situation. They have broken it. Now they've got to fix it. Right. And they're under the gun to do so. There's not a sense of urgency coming out of them. I think that's the real concern. But the longer this goes on, I think the more the potential human cost there is.
Well, let's talk Texas. One of the interesting costs that has come up is about an independent candidate who didn't make the ballot, and he has a particular idea why. What's going on there, Jay?
Yeah, so there was a candidate who had filed, and it was, as we talked about before, Mr. Jenkins is his name, and he's not really a candidate as much as someone who's running kind of off of a for-profit corporation. It was kind of an interesting modern twist on politics here, but he had hired a firm out of California to help collect signatures for him, pay them about $350,000. Lo and behold, they grossly overstated their ability to generate signatures. But the difference is the Jenkins campaign has been arguing that Senator Ted Cruz is to blame, and somehow there's some sort of shenanigans at work.
Yeah, it's unclear why or how this happened. The Jenkins campaign, or Jenkins himself, has filed an election complaint alleging that the Cruz campaign meddled in this effort somehow. Apparently, it stems from an email that has no direct evidence except just the claim that there were offices of this company that were broken into and the individuals were offered money to essentially ditch Texas as part of the petition drive. So it's unclear what's happening. It's an unusual situation. It underscores the fact that, you know, independents have a hard time getting on the ballot. And even if it's the case that you had something that was, you know, potentially interesting for voters and a different view in terms of how one might approach governing, it's still tough to do.
Yeah, you know, for Ted Cruz, this will be interesting because, you know, he was mired a little bit in the Cambridge Analytica issues.
Mm-hmm.
If you recall back when he ran for president in the Iowa caucuses, there were some issues related to automated calls, sort of inaccurately telling people when polls were closing.
Right.
And so all sorts of shenanigans have happened in the past. He's been called out before. We'll see if this actually has any merit. As of now, we don't know that it does. But this is the kind of thing that I think that reinforces potentially that Ted Cruz will try anything to win.
Well, it also is the kind of thing that's probably likely to come up at a debate, right? So there's some controversy about when a debate between Beto O'Rourke and Ted Cruz might happen. Also, there's a debate that has been scheduled between Governor Greg Abbott and his challenger, Dallas County Sheriff Lupe Valdez. So let's start with the O'Rourke and Cruz campaign. O'Rourke says he wants multiple debates, some in Spanish. Ted Cruz says, we'll get to it when we get to it, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because, you know, Ted Cruz, debates are supposed to be what he does.
Yeah,
he's supposed to be sort
debater.
Of this great orator. He's a collegiate champion debater. He's
I mean, at Princeton, but still, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. he's never shied away from conflict, right?
Yeah.
Never shied away from debate. So I thought the expectation, I think, in this was that he would take him on. But if you recall back, I think I've said that before. I'm surprised that he seems to be dodging O'Rourke. And some of that might be because of the fundraising that seems to be developing and some of the polling data that seems to be coming. This race may be a little bit closer than certainly the Cruz people want.
Yeah. I think that if it were like a resolution about healthcare or, you know, nuclear war, Ted Cruz could beat him on merit. But this is a political debate as opposed to like something that takes place in an academic setting. So I don't think that Cruz wants to acknowledge that O'Rourke exists, except to say that O'Rourke is too liberal for Texas, right? O'Rourke's biggest problem is that he's not well known. If Ted Cruz shares a stage with him, he will become better known. So I think the debate dance is going to continue. My guess is there's going to be one debate, I think, at most. And it's going to be the case that O'Rourke is going to get some punches in and Cruz is going to counterpunch. But ultimately, it'll have less influence on the race because it won't be scheduled or organized in such a way that's really going to benefit O'Rourke.
Yeah, I think my dream of sort of a Lincoln Douglas style debate where they're
right.
Touring the entire state of Texas, going in every corner. And
I love it.
I mean, it would be a great visible kind
every
of
county courthouse, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That would be great.
It would be a great thing to see. It's not going to happen. I thought for a moment, because of who Ted Cruz is or his self-belief and his ability to win in that kind of format, would drive him to do it, but it doesn't look that way. Greg Abbott, I think, has done something pretty smart.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, he has taken the reins of organizing a debate,
yeah.
But he was clever enough to pick a time slot that is Friday night,
right,
which, as we know, if you live in the state of Texas, is when folks go watch high school football.
Yeah, and Lupe Valdez's response was like, okay, thanks, let's debate, but let's talk about the day, right? And I don't know that that's enough. I think that they could make some more political hay out of the fact that there's only going to be one debate, and what are you scared of, governor, and let's really have an engaging kind of issue. O'Rourke has done that, I think, with the Cruz side, but Valdez has yet to do that. So I think that accepting the debate may have been a mistake, because they could have made some more political hay out of the fact that, like, you know, you aren't choosing to really talk to Texans, you just want to kind of talk to Republicans. So they maybe could have gotten some political traction from
that. I think Valdez is just lucky that the governor actually uttered her name, because that's probably the most earned media or any media attention she's gotten since the Democratic convention.
Hey, speaking of earning, we've got a bunch of fundraising numbers that are chock full in our email box here. Let's start with the statewide race. O'Rourke and Cruz. O'Rourke put up some mega numbers. What happened?
Yeah, spectacular is probably the best description of it. $10.4 million this quarter, 70% from the state of Texas. Cruz's numbers were good, over $4 million, but just sort of left in the dust with the amount that O'Rourke raised. But troubling for Cruz is almost half of his numbers are from out of state.
Yeah.
That's not a good sign.
And he challenged O'Rourke because O'Rourke was in L.A. for a fundraiser. And he said, oh, you got to go to California to raise money. Well, yeah. Cruz does it too.
Well, and not just that, a good percentage of Cruz's dollars are from corporate PACs. O'Rourke famously takes no corporate dollars. A lot of his money is also small dollar, which allows him to repeat it. This is a positive sign for O'Rourke. It's not a time for certainly for Cruz to be concerned or fearful, because he's going to have a large amount of money. But the issue is Beto O'Rourke isn't going away.
Yeah.
And the numbers are going to continue because of how he's raising money. And so from that perspective, it's a huge win for O'Rourke.
Mm-hmm. Well, he put up big numbers last time too. Not this big, but to me, he needed to show he could do it again, and he did. A lot of people refer to him as Saint Beto, and I think that if you're going to be a saint, as you have to by sort of canon law, you have to do good acts. You have to actually conduct something. And so to me, the reality had to match the hype, and now I think it does. But to me, as important as the total money is how he raised it, right? Small dollar, almost all from Texas. I think that's big. Now, for Cruz, I think to some degree this plays to his hand, right? Cruz wants to claim he's the underdog because that ultimately helps with fundraising. So it could be that this, in some odd way, kind of benefits Cruz. But let's not forget that Wendy Davis also raised big money in her race for governor. And we've had other candidates like Tony Sanchez, who spent a lot of his own money to run for governor in 2002, and it didn't make a dent. So the money is not the only thing here. Now, the money can solve some of the problems, but it's definitely the case that there's more to it than that.
Yeah, the other statewide candidates, I think, did not fare nearly as well on the Democratic side. Lupe Valdez, I think, is running at a pace of what a state rep candidate would raise, raising only about $300,000. She is just so far behind Governor Abbott, who's well over $50 million now. And climbing, that I think that just becomes almost insurmountable, if not already insurmountable. Shifting to some of the congressional races, Brandon, what caught my eye was a lot of the challengers to some of the incumbent Republicans are raising large sums of money here in Houston in CD7. Lizzie Fletcher has mounting a tremendous challenge to John Culberson, raising over $1 million. Similar numbers for Colin Allred in Dallas against Pete Sessions. Almost $1 million, about $984,000. Joseph Cosper in San Antonio, Austin area, raising well over $1 million. Gina Ortiz Jones against Will Hurd down in Corpus in the Valley, San Antonio Valley, over $1 million. Lots of money in these congressional races. Huge stakes here.
Yeah, you've got five new members of the Million Dollar Club, right? The Democrats are definitely opening up their wallets, and that's something that the candidates here need. To put this in context, this is the chaser. In 2016, the Democratic general election challengers to incumbent Republicans only raised about $2.5 million. So we're already well past that number in terms of the raising from the Democrats. So this is really an impressive feat. What also is impressive, too, I don't know if you caught this, but Judge Emmett here in Harris County raised more than $600,000 during the first half of 2018, and he's got almost $1 million on hand. So he's really putting up big numbers, too. He might need it, because Harris County could be a very competitive place for a Republican.
Right. I mean, as much as our friend Mark Jones and others likes to call him the Ferris Bueller of Harris County politics, everyone loves Judge Emmett.
Except
in Harris County, at least, I think we can all agree that there is a strong surge for Democrats, or sort of a blue wave. If it's going to go anywhere, it's going to come here. Ed Emmett probably can withstand that because he's known to hunker down Sorry, I couldn't resist there.
Don't.
I know,
don't
know.
Don't go there. Don't remind us hurricane season.
but yes, this kind of money, I think, insulates him some.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about polling, because there's a Breitbart poll that came out that suggests that Ted Cruz and Governor Abbott are, quote, smoking their competition. What is happening there?
Well, I mean, we've talked about this before. You're going to see polls come and go, and the race is anywhere between, on the Senate side, anywhere between 9 and 5, depending on the mix of registered to likely voters.
Yeah.
When you start going to likely voter polling, it's really about the underlying polling assumptions. What caught my eye in that specific poll was that a poll that showed Cruz up by 9 and the governor, Governor Abbott, up by about 12 to 15 shows Dan Patrick only 2 points up, mm-hmm. and Ken Paxton only 3 points up.
Yeah.
Statistical ties in both races. In fact, I went back and looked, every single poll, both Democratic-leaning, Republican-leaning, and independent, has essentially showed the lieutenant governor's race mm-hmm. and the AG races as within the margin of error. Mm-hmm. Democrats, I think, may need to spend a little more time focusing on that, especially the lieutenant governor's race. That race may be much more in play. We know that he had a Republican challenger that received 25% in the Republican primary. Mm-hmm. Dan Patrick is not a loved man by general election voters. Democrats would be wise. Mike Collier is a centrist Democrat running and might be a much more palatable candidate, particularly if he can raise $5, $6, $7 million. He's not anywhere near that right now,
right.
But that's a race to watch.
Yeah, the problem is resources here. I mean, it could be that advertising some of the things that Paxton did and some of the more extreme positions from Patrick is something that the Democrats could get traction with, but it seems unlikely. I think the reason these numbers are close is in part because these candidates aren't well known. I mean, Dan Patrick, although we know him well, and Ken Paxton, we know him well, they're not well known statewide. This poll was also conducted from July 3rd to July 7th, right at the time where the nation celebrated its Independence Day. So people were more concerned with fireworks than they were with answering poll questions. In fact, I think that my wife got a call during this very phase. So it could have been that she was somebody who also suggested that she wasn't going to take this poll, although it's odd. I usually try to convince her to, because you want that number to be higher. The problem of people turning down the opportunity to be interviewed is that the margin of error is increasing, and that in this poll was about 4%, which is a little higher than you might want. To me, all the Democrats are about 40%, right? 40, 41%. That's probably, you know, a little lower, but once the undecideds come back, you're going to get to about 44%. The question is, how much higher can they get than that? And I think that's still the wild card that's going to be decided really by what the wave looks like and sort of how much money is raised.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about the big issue of the week, and that's the president's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh as a Supreme Court justice.
So, Jay, Justice Kennedy has decided he's going to step down from the bench. The president nominated Judge Kavanaugh to replace him. What is your take on what this is going to look like? Is Kavanaugh a centrist replacement for Kennedy, or is he more to the right? Are the votes there to be able to confirm, or are we still talking about a tough confirmation fight?
I think you're going to get a tough confirmation fight regardless, but I think the votes are clearly there. This was designed in two ways. One, he does not have the public record against Roe v. Wade or against sort of this notion of stare decisis, which is recognition and appreciation of precedent that some of the other judges did. I think it'll be enough to allow folks like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski mm-hmm. To be supportive of him. He's not a centrist. He is a conservative, not to the extreme, I should say, of Neil Gorsuch when you look at his appellate record. But he is certainly not Anthony Kennedy. The court will be more conservative under him, but he's going to get confirmed. The question, I think, is a political one for Democrats, particularly ones in red states. Do they vote for him, making that number 57-58, or do you stick to that 50-51 number with just a party line vote?
That's a good point. I think on abortion, he's in the middle enough and his position is ambiguous enough to probably give him the benefit of the doubt for those wavering Republicans. Remember, part of the reason that some of the conservatives objected to him was that they thought he wasn't, you know, clear enough on Roe v. Wade. Some of his decisions have been kind of in the middle. So to me, he's similar to a Kennedy or an O'Connor. He'll probably follow precedent, but it won't necessarily be to the liking of all those Republicans. What about presidential power and about administration? This is really going to be a major factor in terms of how the Trump administration leaves its legacy. Where does he stand on that? And kind of what do you think is that's going to be in terms of where is that going to fit in terms of this confirmation battle?
Yeah, that's really the big controversy around Brett Kavanaugh is he has some legal opinions, but more to the point, he's written some opinion pieces in law reviews that essentially underscores his belief that sitting presidents are not eligible to be criminally indicted, regardless of their circumstance.
And this comes after he was part of the team that was investigating.
He was on 10 Star's investigation team of Whitewater during the 90s. He was in the Bush White House. But the big central issue is, and just to be clear on this, what Judge Kavanaugh says is that the impeachment process is itself the way you deal with presidents who are sitting in power. Because of separation of power arguments, you cannot criminally indict a sitting president and try him as a criminal because he is by definition outside of that branch. And so as a consequence, that's the position he's taken. Some have interpreted this as the get out of jail free card for Donald Trump, which I think is a considerable overstatement.
I think so too, but this is an Achilles heel for him, right? I think that a lot of his time as a judge won't be as persuasive as the time he spent in the Bush White House, right? And the time he spent working in politics. That's where I think a lot of the concern is going to be. And the Democrats, I think, can probably develop a case that suggests that he's too partisan for the office. I don't know if it's true or not, but that's a case that I think they can clearly make given his tenure and his time in politics.
Yeah, he was in the Bush White House for 5 years. Yeah. There's a long paper trail of probably political activity, a long email trail and interviews around that. And so I think we need to be careful to say it's a slam dunk that he's going to get confirmed. But I do think right now, from what we know publicly, he's likely to. He himself, when he was appointed to the Court of Appeals, faced a bruising confirmation battle for the same reasons you laid out, particularly on the fact that he had been a partisan player, which is very unusual.
Yeah. Now, there's been some stories that have come out on the lighter side that say that he has basically mortgaged his credit cards to pay for tickets to the Washington Nationals. What do you make of this?
Well, first off, the choice of baseball team doesn't offend me, but I'm concerned about his overall judgment just based
on that.
Better
than the Cowboys, right?
So. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But that said, I mean, I think this is an attempt to try to humanize him and make him more relatable.
It works in his favor, I think.
Yeah, and I think it certainly does work in his favor. But I think overall, I mean... how he is portrayed, you know, how he's dealt with. This is a confirmation battle that deals almost exclusively with 2 to 3 senators.
Right,
that's all that were in play. If you can convince Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and if John McCain is able to vote on it, John McCain, those are really the only three at this stage that actually matter.
Yeah, an analysis from the Boston Globe suggested Collins has voted with Republican presidential nominees 99% of the time. This could be the one where it goes the other way, but I think it's logical to think that she's probably going to be on board unless there's something explosive that happens.
Well, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to tell you what we think happens with this confirmation and what it might mean for the court going forward.
So, Jay, obviously this is blockbuster news. Kennedy resigns and you've got a new justice. This person is likely to put their stamp on American politics for a very long time. What's your take on what's happening and why should people care?
Well, I think this sort of continues the rightward tilt of the court. Mm-hmm. I think a continuation of conservative principles that to move into the Supreme Court, particularly you'll probably see an erosion of Roe v. Wade, probably not an outright repeal of Roe v. Wade. I think what's going to happen is the right and abortion rights as a whole will continue to be eroded away over time. But again, President Trump is remaking the court. And this is a young justice. He'll be there potentially for 25 to 30 years. Going forward, we're going to have a more conservative judiciary and a structural basis. And that's 1/3 of the government.
Jay, break out the 90s music because we are going to relitigate the Lewinsky scandal and all the things therein and the Bush White House's rights and wrongs. So it's going to be back to the 90s week, Jay. I think that's probably going to be damaging for him. I don't think it's probably enough that it's going to cause Republicans to not vote for him. But I don't think that there's enough pressure then to make these red state Democrats side with him. So ultimately, I think you're going to get confirmation by just a whisper, but he will be confirmed. In terms of the big picture where the court's going, I don't think abortion and same-sex marriage are going to be like the big issues. I think that the big issues are going to be religious liberty and about the reach of the administrative state. He has been a fairly consistent advocate of precedent. And so as a result, you're going to see, I think you're right, a chipping away at some of these rights, a limitation of these rights, the same way that Roberts and his sort of philosophy has chipped away at them. But I don't think you're going to see outright overturning. So you're going to see a conservative court the way Trump and Republicans want, but it's not going to be an ultra-conservative court in a direct way.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
A big thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci. Special kudos to our web team, Giselle Bueno, Matt Prendergast, and to our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the nominee, Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.